Hello everyone, welcome to Darren Matthews and Sometimes Friends, the podcast where I speak to people much more interesting than myself. Please enjoy. Good morning, as it is morning time here, and welcome to episode 20 of Darren Matthews and Sometimes Friends, the podcast where I talk to people much more interesting than myself. Episode 20, didn't think we'd get this far, and to celebrate, I've got a man who's about to play an arena, so Paddy Raff, morning.
Alright, how's it going?
I'm dead on, boys, how's you?
Sweet, yeah, all good.
You're going to play an arena in a week and you're sweet?
Yeah, it's all sitting there, it's all ready to go. It's just kind of want to do it now you get that stage.
Sort of a true professional. I was going to say, for those who don't know, but fuck sake, Paddy's, you've been kicking around for a year or two now doing your famous thing. Who's more famous, Paddy or Nigel?
More recognisable, I think, Nigel, because like there's so many bald people knocking about. It's like, we all look the same, that trope. Many times I've been like Funky Monkeys and kids come up to me going, "Daddy, Daddy," and I'm like, "Not your daddy." And then the mom goes, "Oh, sorry, so her daddy's bald as well." So yeah, I think that like I just blend in, but yeah, people recognise Nigel. It's good though, because I don't like, whenever I get stopped for pictures or like people chat me and I'm out, it's weird. So I'm happy that whenever someone's talking to me and they're like, "Do you know what this fella is? This is Paddy Raff." I'm like, "Who?" Like, "Nigel the fella." "What? That's him?" Like, nobody puts the connect. They just don't see that it's me. So yeah, it's...
Well, I was going to say, just the first point to stop you on was when you're like, obviously when kids are coming up being like, "Are you my daddy?" Is that just a West Belfast thing where nobody's totally sure?
Well, that's it. I always think it's like, is this some kind of like sting operation where if I say, you know, if I answer this child, is somebody going to jump in and go, "Haha, you owe me 18 years worth of, you know, CSA or whatever."
It's like a subpoena.
Yeah. You've been served. So yeah, I just kind of ignore them. Even if they're my own kids, just ignore them, Funky Monkeys.
And pretend that, yes, I don't know them. I'm here my own. No, that's the wrong answer.
Can we go on the Funkies in your own?
Oh man, so dude, yeah, I don't know if you, obviously you probably do this better because you have to, but I keep calling the SSE the Odyssey, but we're doing the SSE Arena, because yeah, that's what it was when it opened.
Yeah.
I mean, I know you've done loads of bigger gigs already. You did that whole big run down the line, right? How are you feeling?
Brilliant, actually. Yeah, the only reason I ended up doing the SSE or booking it wasn't like I like had this in my mind, because I only tried comedy for a bit of crack, never thinking it was going to work out. And it's kind of like just took me along, you know, doing things online and getting a bit of a following early on meant that people were like asking me, where are you gigging and whatever else. So I kind of had to start putting my own gigs on. But yeah, after the run in the limelight and the finishing the two sold out Ulster Hall, it was like, when you finish that, I was like, where do you go? What's next? And I had my sort of eye set on the waterfront, because I've loved every gig I've been to in there, whether it's comedy or, you know, a band or whatever. But speaking to the promoter, he was just like, you might end up just sheer by the numbers of what I'd done with the postcode show. It was like, you may as well have a crack at the SSE. And I just went on their recommendation. I was like, as long as you don't think that we'll put this up, and they'll be like, "Paddy, we fucked up here." I was like, "Let's come and shift the venue to somewhere smaller." I was like, "I'll trust you." So yeah, that was purely on their, like I say, it's not something that I aim for. I think if you aim, I don't really have goals like that, you know, like American families, you know, aim big, my kid wants to be this, wants to be this. We're never like that, just like, whatever happens. So yeah, booked the SSE, and that first one sold out in like 3 weeks, which was absolutely insane. And that's why we stuck on a second night. And that one's near sold out. So it's just, I'm totally just, I'm overwhelmed by it. You know, overwhelmed in it, not like as in I can't fucking do it, but like overwhelmed as in, it's just, that is the amount of people that want to come see this stuff. Because I don't like kind of hammering people, come to this. And I would hate to have to do that. I would hate to have put it on and go, "Oh Jesus, I really have to promote it." So I'm just like, yeah, I'll put it on in that venue and people want to come to see it, you know, fair enough. But it's, I've enjoyed actually writing this show, because with the last one, it felt like it went on for too long, almost, because we started it in March, and by the time we finished it in the Ulster Hall, it was like August. I just kind of wanted to get past that and move on. So the tour that I'd just done, like four venues, sort of, what was it, Maher of Felt and stuff like that in Derry all went really well, and that was the new material.
Yeah, and, I think that must be comforting to be able to go,
yeah,
I know it works, because you don't want to walk out in the audience and go,
no,
right then.
I mean, like, that's what I really admire about all the comedians that are on the scene and doing spots all over the place. That is more nerve-wracking to me. I genuinely would be more nerve-wracking sitting, you know, side stage for the Pavilion, headline of the Pavilion, than sitting backstage at the SSE about to walk out. I would genuinely be more nervous about that.
I have two standout gigs that I remember from either when I was in the country or we were gigging together. One of the ones was number one whenever we first met down in XXX Legger, whenever Cormac was putting on gigs.
That's right, I forgot about that.
When we were doing that gig, I think you on the gig with a really drunk lady came in and the crowd booed her out of the...
Yeah, that's right.
Myself and Cormac talked about this in the podcast, so that was one of the gigs, and the second gig was whenever we did the American Bar. I was headlining, and Paddy did this very funny thing where you were getting up and you were like, I'm going to do a song about Belfast, and then realised that most of the crowd weren't from Belfast. So it was like watching a director's commentary of a movie, because you kept stopping the song and going, right, let me explain what an Eagle Taxi is.
Yeah. It was like a meeting of the UN when you were like asking where's everybody from. I was expecting, right, we might get a few people from the Short Strand somewhere far flung like that, and there was guys from Sri Lanka and Malaysia and Americans, and then there were Scottish girls in front of me, and there was a German and all, and you were like having to crack with them, but that was probably like about my sixth gig ever, and I was just like going, oh, how am I going to explain what an Eagle Taxi is to these guys? So that just came out of nowhere. Yeah, it was like the director's commentary, rewinding back every line and going, so yeah, that ended up kind of making the gig.
But it was brilliant, because if people talk about, oh, there can be a danger of, you know, like musical comedy, if there's like, because obviously one of the components of music is a course which is repeated. So you're like, but there was no danger of you repeating a punchline, because you kept stopping.
I forgot about that.
You were like improving your material because you were like, I've never done this before.
Yeah, that was insane.
You're like, I pretty much play this to my wife, who knows every reference I'm talking about here.
Even something over her head, like, but yeah, that's the main challenge now, is like sort of broadening the material. Because I know you talked about doing gigs and like you've toured Asia and shit, like, you know.
Yeah, it's good fun.
But like, where do you, was your material in the earlier days, I suppose, maybe quite colloquial and
narrow? Oh yeah, when I am home, I will hammer the colloquialisms, when I'm away, because I don't, but the thing is, I don't do it all the time, it's because I don't get to do it when I'm away.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm not in Kuala Lumpur going, does anybody get the reference of what if I talk about like people in Armagh making their own diesel?
Yeah, you have to find out what their local, you know, sort of equivalent of that is.
I mean, but one of the good things was when I was doing that tour, I was backpacking as I was going.
Yeah.
So I was landing in a country for a few days, having a wee wander about,
class.
And then writing new bits.
Yeah, they appreciate that. I can't remember who it was listening to, saying about going out and doing a gig somewhere, and like start off with, even if it's not the best material, just start off with local stuff and they'll lap it up.
That was Mickey, that was my podcast.
Oh, was it? That's right, yes, I was scrolling through it the last time, yeah. That's a good thing. I love talking to, like say William Thompson and stuff has done MC at a few of my gigs, and he's like, it's because I've got the two kids, and whenever I started doing comedy in, was it March, nearly 2 years ago now, like I had the two kids then, so I was up to my eyes and potty training and shit, and that was just me, it wasn't even the kids, just potty training myself. And it was like really hard to get out and get all the gigs going, and it's getting even worse now, because when you take on so much work comedy wise that I'm doing, it's like I've got that as the full time job, and I've got the two kids as well, and it's like sort of I want to be out in the scene and doing all these shit gigs and down on my hole in places where it's only like 20 people. So you have the experience of what works and what doesn't, but it's like you're kind of damned if you do, damned if you don't, because there's benefits to going out and just doing your own thing, you know, on a tour or whatever. But I do miss that period where I've met you twice, then we would have gigged together, where I got to go out and see how other people are doing it and sort of make the mistakes in front of a very small crowd of people.
Yeah,
but it's I'm lucky in a way that when people come to the shows, like nothing I've done in the new set has, I've never got to the end of a joke and it hasn't landed, but it's been a scale of a titter of laugh up to a full scale belly laugh.
Yeah.
But at least there's never, I haven't died yet. That could happen.
Well, look, Paddy, at the same time, while it's great to have that artistic integrity, I would also like to pay off my mortgage. So, so fair play to you, because you need to get on that one. What are your, I reckon two Odysseys, you can clear the mortgage and maybe have enough left for a holiday in Bundoran.
See, I've a caravan in Downings and Donegal, so we go a wee bit further than Bundoran. But
okay,
that's not my say. It's, I've got, it's the typical thing. It's my ma's. Like I get more use out of it than she does. But I've kind of went all bells all whistles for this SSE gig, because like the Nigel stuff and it being a wee bit bigger. Like I've, the pianist that I bring with me, who's one of my best friends, who actually lived in this street. He, like, renting a piano and stuff like that, the cost of all that shit, you go, well, it's SSE, you've got to have a grand piano, because I was lucky in the Ulster Hall, they actually have one, the Ulster Orchestra's one is kept there, so
yeah,
there's no real cost, you'll just have to pay, like, 80 quid for somebody to tune it, but for the SSE to get a piano up to it, from the place that we're going to rent from is like a grand, and I'm like, really, can I not just get, a wee keyboard or something?
Yeah, like, can I just plug in the Casio here? Yeah.
So we're kind of like struggling with stuff like that. So there's expenses, but yeah, it's like two nights in the SSE. I think I might try and maybe retire after this. live in the caravan up in Donegal.
Going high, yeah. And just live in the coolest place on earth. So obviously the caravan's up there. We'll go back a bit into your past then. How long was Donegal the go-to holiday destination as a child?
Oh, aye.
Because it was for me. We went to the same caravan at Killybegs 4 years in a row.
Where's Killybegs on the, like, sort of... Because we always just went to Downings and Donegal and Dunfanaghy's where we went to, like, the very top.
Killybegs is essentially a fishing port, or it was, so it just reeks of fish. Lovely beach, like, but the place stinks of fish. My mum was like, let's go there for holidays. And I was like, honest to God, look, come on. The Protestants are going to Spain. Can we not? And they're like, no, get in the car.
Aye, well, we went to... See, that's the thing as well, that the myth with people knowing Nigel more than they would know me is they assume that I'm a BT9er, and that because I do that accent and stuff, that, oh, I must have been middle class. And we were, like, absolutely broke when we were... Like, we lived in a mid-terrace, three-bedroom house in West Belfast, and there were seven of us. Well, with five kids and, like, my dad, so... It was we're like crammed in there. So we used to get up to Donegal, the Downings, and rent the house every, what, like for 2 weeks over the 12th. The mass exodus of all the Teagues fucking off over the 12th.
Yeah.
That loved going up to Donegal. It was the only time I had a room, like, almost to yourself. It's a big farmhouse, like. So I was Dunfanaghy. So every summer we're up there. And then Downings from like the year 2000 onwards is we've had a caravan up there since then.
Do you know why? Because your ma had everybody sort of up to a scale where she wasn't spending a fortune.
That's what it was.
Because I've got five kids raised, I got a fortune.
I kind of wondered where we got the money from. I thought she must have put in a claim or something. But yeah, literally, whenever we all got sort of, I think I was like 16 at the time. Yeah, 2000. We got this caravan coming out of nowhere, and we never could have afforded that. So that was that. We had, and we had my sister's disabled. I talk about it in my show. So that was the other thing, was that any extra wee bit of money, while all my mates in school, because I somehow ended up in school in South Belfast, and I was like one of the few Westies in my year. It was like some kind of schmick repatriation scheme, you know, like had that one in every year.
Like they got funding for you.
Yeah. Like there was a quota. And I remember like all my mates were going to skiing holidays and stuff, and I would have come in and asked my mom, can we go skiing? And she looked at you as if you just asked her, can we go to the fucking moon? Like, what? And student with no money, and the reason with no money, I only found out after I grew up, was that every extra bit of money we had was spent by mama and dad on taking the trust to court because of my sister's disability. She was born totally fine, and then she had a pneumonia at the, like, about 3 weeks old, and brought into hospital, and they fucked up the car. There was a change of shift, and they didn't change her oxygen tank, and she ended up, you know, disabled.
Fucking hell.
For our car. So yeah, I talk about it in the show, like about being one of her cars and stuff, and the kind of the fun things that happen there. And it's not always like that. But I didn't realise growing up that the reason we had no money was because as soon as any extra money came in from anything, because my dad worked in a factory and my mum was a nurse, it just went to taking the trust to court.
Dude, if I had asked my dad, can we go skiing, he would have asked me what fucking county that's in. He's like, does Armagh play him in the National League? No, well then you're not fucking going.
Aye, funny enough, my dad had a ski mask for some reason, but he never went skiing, you know.
Oh man, so that's something I want to go back in, because obviously people... a lot of people's first interaction was with, this is fucking going to sound like some sort of weird schizophrenic explanation, with Paddy doing the party songs, and then Nigel appeared as, was Nigel a Snapchat filter? Do I remember that right?
Yeah, because I didn't know what kind of comedy I wanted to do whenever I started doing it. I knew I played the guitar, obviously I was in a wedding band at that time, and that's something I've always done, is I've always changed the lyrics to songs. And so in school, well, if there was a song that was massive in the charts, I would have like changed it to slag a teacher normally. That's something I've always done. And whenever the early days of me doing comedy, sort of from like March 2018 to that summer, was pretty much based around music and the guitar. And then I'd started on the page doing Snapchat filters, and the Nigel one came about just, it looked like that, the moustache and the bushy kind of hair and the glasses. And I think the first one I did of that was the Hosepipe Band, and it went viral. It was the first one that went quite big, and then people kept going after that. Like weeks later, I hadn't done another one. Oh, you have to do that posh character again. So then,
you're like, I need to remember what you're on about. Like, yeah, go back and watch this.
That's the thing with Snapchat filters, is they come off and on at mad intervals. There's no rhyme and no reason, and you can't save them, I don't think, anyway. So it got to the stage where people were asking for more of those posh videos, because I didn't even have a name for the character. I was like, I can't do them. There's no, the filter's gone. And then after I did my first solo show, which is I think in July of that year, that's whenever the Nigel stuff had started to gather a bit of traction. And people were like, oh, we want to come, would you do that live? And I sat there thinking, actually, if I could recreate that look, I might have a crack at it. And that's what I did then. That was the second solo show I put on, was September that year. And it was, that one sold out. First one sold well as well. Like, it was like 150 people out of 250 cap, I think, Palm House was. But that second one sold out, and I was like, right, okay, maybe there's a bit of clout to be had here with Nigel. And it went brilliant. And that was the first time I'd actually enjoyed being on stage. It was so fucking nerve-wracking before that. And whenever I walked out, I thought that would have been the worst. But walking out as a character, it just feels like you're not on stage as yourself. You're almost like watching yourself from a different perspective.
Yeah, I do the Farmer Michael and Kathleen tour.
Oh, that's massive.
So I gig with the guys, and I said to Steve, I goes, is it weird not being you? He says, no, it's weird when people think you're them. Like, if you ever meet Steve, he's a really lovely lad, but obviously Michael's a thick farmer.
Yeah,
but they don't dress up. There's no. Nigel has a look.
Aye,
he has a nice jacket and the hair and stuff. And
so does he do the full show as Farmer Michael?
He does the full show as Farmer Michael, and Sinead plays Kathleen, so she's the sort of the straight man in the double act.
Yeah.
So they have the dynamic that works for him. But I said to Steve, he goes, is it weird? He goes, it's kind of strange because you're playing a character who has no filter anyway.
Yeah.
So you can say whatever you want.
Mm-hmm.
But the cleverness is, you think of something funny and then go, how does he say it?
Yeah.
Is that weird? Do you have to do that too? Because go, there's a joke, and then you're like, does Paddy tell that one?
Yes, or do I give that? That is so right. I think that's kind of part of, I was lucky, like I say, I didn't plan on having a character or having any characters. It was just, I'm going to do comedy and see what way it works out. But it's worked out really well in that if I think of something funny, I'd be like, if it hasn't come from personal experience and you've written something, I do go, is that something that I would say, or is that something, no, I will see, would Nigel say that? And if it's neither, then you just park it and you're like, I might write that into something at some stage later. But it means that whenever you go out and do a show, you can almost say all the funny things you've ever thought, because it's like, well, if I can't work it into my set, then I can work it into Nigel's. And it means that people get a broader idea of the comedy that you can do, because, like I said, you can feed that to Nigel. But that's the thing about thinking about it, not being able to do it on the hoof. Like, there's people that have tried to book me for shows and like TV appearances, and even like BBC Northern Ireland have certain pitches out looking for panel shows and all that. And there's ones have come to me going, oh, like, we really good to have Nigel front in this show. And I couldn't do it because I could write.
Sorry, buddy, we got interrupted there by my postbox going. So you said it's weird, but people want Nigel to like
on the hoof. Yeah, like you can write it, like sit at home and give us the brief, what do you want? But like if you're on a panel show, like I loved watching, what was that, like, They Think It's All Over, Nevermind the Buzzcocks. And 90% of that is the ad-libbing and reacting to what other people have said. And that's what happens whenever I'm doing appearances as Nigel. When people are going off on one, I think of something funny and then I have to check myself and go, would Nigel say that? Or is that me would say that? He wouldn't say X. And I'm drawing on my experience as a working class person. And like, Nigel wouldn't know anything about that area, or Nigel wouldn't know, you know, what it's like to be on the dole queue, which I do. So it's like, would Nigel say that? And a lot of the times he wouldn't. So you have to kind of think ahead. So I wouldn't do... That's why this, the TV stuff that I'm sort of planning and working on with producers is scripted, you know, comedy drama, as opposed to him hosting the show and then having to sit and think, okay, and just sitting like a fucking deer in the headlights as other people riff around you.
Is it really weird to be making a living off your undiagnosed schizophrenia?
that's a good way to put it. Yeah, it's class, like, a bit, because it was, like I say, I was playing in a wedding band and it didn't feel like work at the time. And then I went back and did a gig after having done the comedy for, it was during the Paddy and Nigel Actor Postcode show last year. In between some of the gigs, I kind of stepped away from the band. I was still managing it, because I used to manage our band and gigged in it and DJed in it, and then I managed another band. So I was still managing them off, you know, emails and shit like that, and keeping on top of the gigs. And I went and did one, and Jesus, this actually is a lot of hard work. Because we turn up at the weddings at about like 7 o'clock, and you have to put a full rig of gear together. You drummed, didn't you? You were a drummer.
Yeah, not in the wedding band, though. I was very much a punk and a rocker, like, but I know lads playing, like, lads I would have played with,
yeah,
have progressed on to wedding band, so yeah. You know, we're all going to write the head album and change the world, and then
and then
now we're playing fucking Sweet Caroline,
Brown Eyed Girl.
Brown Eyed Girl somewhere in Monaghan.
Whenever you get Four Seasons Monaghan, always loving it there. And what was the other one in there, the West End or the Western or something? But you like going back to that and realizing how much hard work that was, made me go, I'm glad I'm doing comedy, because whenever I walk into a gig now, all the equipment's there, and it's like, go up and say 1-2 into the mic, test your guitar, test this head mic for Nigel, and then that's you, go backstage. So it feels a lot easier.
We'll do one for the music nerds. What sort of guitar are you playing? Did you go with a new one for the bigger gigs? Or
yeah,
are you still using rocking
I'm
the guitar
on,
you
I'm
had?
On a Loudon now. Yeah, I know. I've never...
He's doing well for himself.
Never thought I would end up... But it was like, it was good. I was chatting to them, liaising with them. Because I've always loved their guitars. A few of the people I know that gig out and about have play them. And it's like...
They're serious bits of gear. Like,
oh, they're amazing. And
I can play a few chords, but it's like hugging a wee pillow when you get that, you know what I mean?
Yeah. Oh, I thought it sounded like a piano.
Yeah.
But I had to get it. It was one of those things where the last guitar was almost, which was brilliant as well. It was the Taylor, but it's because of the places I was gigging, and because I live in the exact same house. I say structurally the same house that I grew up in as a kid. So it's another 3-bedroom mid terrace, and we have 2 kids and shitloads of stuff I'm accumulating. So the house is coming down on top of us. So I'm having to like store the guitar in places where a lot of moisture and shit's getting at it. So that last one anyway, and the tuning was shit, because I would move the capo around a lot when I'm playing my stuff, and if your guitar's a bit warped and you start putting the capo on, frets coming higher, it just sounds really out of tune. So even at the Ulster Hall, I got to that stage, and I brought it to matches and then reset it. And by the time I got to the gig, it was still, I was like, nah, you can't be doing that. You can't be fucking scrimping and being stingy if people are putting their hand in their pockets for tickets. So it's like, you got to repay that respect. So I treated myself to a guitar. It's
fair
a strange
enough.
Way to look at it.
It would be funny, obviously, if you walk out in the SSC arena with like, a Westfield and a Roland cube amp beside you with a wee
Stag,
microphone to it.
A Stag, that was my first guitar, was a Westfield and a Sound King 5-watt amp. Yeah, you can't be doing that shit. But it was funny because I was down at the factory, Loudon factory, and I was chatting to them about their Ed Sheeran range, and his guitars are too small. I mean, his guitars look small on him, and he's apparently small.
Aye,
so whenever I held one of his, it felt like a mandolin. So
ukulele.
I was like, nah, I'm not going to be playing those ones. But apparently his ones are shite, as in, no, the range is good, but the one that he uses, he like spent ages and he's ripped all the electronics out of it and shit, because of the venues he gigs in, you get a lot of frequencies and stuff. And
oh, okay.
So apparently the actual guitar he gigs with, they're like, we couldn't put that on the shelf because people are like, what the fuck's this? So his range is like a copy almost, but a bit specced up.
So the SSE, you're going to be out, your mate's playing a grand piano and you're playing a loud guitar?
No, he was supposed to be playing a grand piano, but that's too dear now. I can't justify that. No, if we can get the grand piano from the Ulster Hall, yes. That was the setup from the postcode show. It was, well, in the Limelight, which is where most of the shows were, it was keyboard, guitar, and a bit of AV stuff now in it as well. Because the drummer in our band, who was actually a better guitarist than me. It was like that thing about the Beatles. You know what they say about Ringo? John Lennon was apparently asked, is Ringo Starr the best drummer in the world? He says he's not even the best drummer in the Beatles.
Yeah.
But apparently that's not even true. That was a Jasper Carrot joke. I've like looked into it. But yeah, in our band, I was nowhere near the best guitarist because our drummer, who was a brilliant drummer, is like a grade 8 guitar teacher. But he's also a professional sound tech for a lot of bands. He's done a lot of tours around Europe and whatever. So I just happened to have a brilliant sound engineer that I could call on to help make all this work. So it wouldn't have been as flashy without having a mate that could come in and say, I'll handle all your AV and I'll get you a great sound and let's get that Steinway Grand mic'd up and all. He just knows his shit, you know.
Isn't it really nice, obviously, because people talk about here being such a small place, but sometimes it's good.
Oh, aye, because
you like when you're like, I know a guy can do that.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is the most West Belfast thing ever. Hey, man, hey, I know a lad, sort of. Well, you need that cardboard out at the White Rock.
I get you a microphone from Nuts Corner. Don't you worry, six pack.
Yeah, sure, spelt with no H.
Yeah, I. Or sure now, more like. So yeah, that's you're dead right about knowing people that can do. But like I'm lucky in that Pete is the sound engineer is one of the most sought after. Not even here, any bands he's gigged with, he's done tours with likes of big rock bands like Evanescence and stuff like that.
Oh, okay,
like Mojo Fury locally, he done their sound for years and stuff. So even like the bass player to Mojo Fury, Ronnie, he whenever I wanted to do my parody songs as a live band, I was able to go, right, Ronnie, on bass, if you're up for it, yep, no problem. And then one of my mates being another great guitar teacher, the band were phenomenal, and I ended up just like just doing fucking joke songs about Millies with like amazing musicians. So yeah, it's class to be able to call on these people and put something together.
I think when you go see big bands like that, though, I mean, when you get into that big production stage, no matter what you think of, like whenever you go see anybody doing it, it's all their musicians are always top drawer. Usually, as you say, like those guys are better skilled than the dudes going to see.
The session musicians are the most top notch, and that's the funny thing. Yeah, like bands, whenever you're growing up, the actual members of the core band that formed it end up being the worst musicians on stage by the end of their career because they end up getting session musicians in to kind of bolster the sound, and then you're like, these are top notch players that are virtuoso, and the guys that you grew up listening to are the four chord wonders on the guitar.
I mean, that's what probably gives you a good song. I've been to see bands like Green Day and Stereophonics, and they've like, I think the first time I saw Green Day was three piece,
yeah.
And then now, I mean, Billy Joe Armstrong barely plays his guitar now.
There's lots of
it dropping it and hands up.
And then when you look at it,
one of the guys is on the corner flat out.
You stand there and you watch, and that's such a. I did a bit about it whenever the rescheduled Ulster Hall show after the fire alarm. People were coming back and I was like, they hadn't seen the Nigel set, but they'd seen my set. I was like, I'm not going to repeat the same set. So I kind of wrote the new set for them. And I talked about, I'd been to see Metallica and Slain. And I was talking about like the difference between going to a gig after when you're past 30, as opposed to before, you know, when you're younger. Big and time. You stand there like, you know, with your arms folded and you want to get a safe space. You don't want to be too close to the mosh pit, but close enough that you can see what's going on. And that's one of the things you do is you stand and you end up counting how many people are on stage and nudging your mate. And whereas before you'd be in the middle of the mosh pit, you're sitting there going, here, there's 12 of them on stage, 12. Then you go, what you reckon they're on? And then you start working out. You start calculating your phone out. We were genuinely standing there. How many people are at this gig?
And much is a ticket.
How much is the ticket price? How much you reckon then? We thought we had it calculated, and then Metallica had this massive pyrotechnic show at the end. We're going, here, factor that in. No, factor that in. Oh, they're not clearing much, like, are they? Not unless they got the fireworks from Nuts Corner, like, cut price, but no, okay.
But yeah, that was one of the things, because you did the sort of trajectory of the thing was, you did your own show, then you did the Limelight, and that run was incredible. And then you were like, we're going to do the Ulster Hall. And I was like, fucking settle down, Paddy. And then you did loads of them.
But the
one thing was, what the firearm thing, my God.
Yeah, that was, I mean, that run of shows, I think that people maybe have this impression that I'm like in there going, I'm going to do this, I'm going to fucking do that. I was like, no, it was literally I booked the Mac, which was, for me, I wanted a theatre. I'd done like places like the Palm House, which like they let the bar stay open during the gig and stuff like that. And that was something I could have said no to, but I didn't know to do that. So I'd made the mistakes of having crowds that were chatting at the bar and all that shit. And then I did the Empire, which was brilliant, but again, it was a lot of standing, you know. And then so like booked the Mac, because like, no, I think it needs a theatre. And so those Mac ones sold out so fucking quick. I was not expecting it. And I just thought, well, I'll do those three and that's it. So I did those three. And then I was getting people messaging me going, you got to put that show on again. I want to go. I want to bring blah, blah, blah. So that's when I went to the Limelight then. And we ended up doing four in the Limelight. And again, I didn't book four. I booked one. And then it sold out so quick. I went, oh, okay, I'll book another one. And then again, and that's the reason why I went to the Ulster Hall, is because I was on the verge of announcing a fifth Limelight, and I felt a bit samey. Felt like, you know, I'm not really offering anything different. And that's when the Limelight's 450 capacity seated, and the Ulster Hall is like double that, the wee bit. And they went, ah, do you know what, I'll finish it with one at the Ulster Hall. And then it sold out, and fuck, I'll do another one. But yeah, the first one was the fire alarm one, and that was just crazy. I mean, I can laugh looking back on it, because it worked out in my favour. Because, well, what happened was, on the night then, I'd done my first half. So the show that I do normally is first half me, so like 45 minutes me, interval, and then that allows me to go and get changed and whatever else, and then come back on and do 35-40 as Nigel, and then I run off and get changed, because it's quicker to get out of the costume than it is to get into it.
Yeah.
Come back on and finish off 10 minutes of myself, because you can't be nice, you can't say thanks to everybody as Nigel, because he wouldn't do that. So that's why I like to come back out. But so I'd done the first half as me, and I was up getting changed, and it was ready. It was literally standing side stage with the microphone in my hand, ready to do the entrance as Nigel, and the fire alarm went off, and you kind of go, right, well, they'll shut it off in a wee second. And the guys were like, they were running full pelt up and down the corridors, and you could tell this is serious. And it just went on and on. They couldn't get it shut off, and they had this kick everybody out.
Oh no, we like, is this what's is, yeah, because it's like when the fire alarm goes off and you're in school,
yeah,
and
everyone's, yeah,
like, whoa, happy, and then like 30 seconds later,
uh-huh,
who did that?
Well, that was, I thought it was going to be knocked off, and that would be us, you know, on stage soon. And we were told, oh, it'll be off, you'll be getting on stage, don't worry. And then, nah, it didn't, it just kept going. And after 45 minutes, the crowd were starting to turn on the venue, because they were asking the staff what the fuck's going on. And it was it roasting? Yeah, it was roasting. The aircon had gone off, so, and it was middle of summer. So yeah, it was mad. But the reason it was a good thing in the end was because during my first half, up in the balconies at the very front, there was people literally like flagging me down, going, we can't hear you, we can't hear anything.
Yeah.
And you know yourself, like gigging in bands and stuff like that, an old venue like the Ulster Hall, it's designed to reflect all the noise, because there was never a PA in it.
Yeah, it was orchestra and projected speech.
And so, but once you start putting in a PA and you've got more people in there, you have to really be in control of the sound and firing speakers at people. Basically, it turned out that the sound on the night, nothing to do with Pete, but the speakers they gave them, there was ones that weren't working. So whenever we got to the end, there was people then sending messages the next day saying, I won't be back because of the sound was so bad. And I kind of had to explain, like, it was nothing to do with us. And whenever they put the rescheduled date on, the only tickets that people wanted refunded were in those exact pockets, like you can see on the floor map.
Yeah, when it goes green, they weren't coming
and
back.
The ones went green, whereas the exact extreme left and right on the balcony, and a bit down at the front as well. So it was kind of, it was good, because then for the rescheduled show and for the show then we put on after that, we brought in extra gear, and it was, the sound was amazing then. So
the moral of the story is, don't get your PF in that corner.
Yeah, that must be where they got it from.
That's such a strange structure as well, because obviously whenever we do shows, so like Farmer Michael and Kathleen, they have me emceeing, or they have me supporting, and I'm somebody else.
Yeah,
you're your MC and your support act.
Mm, yeah.
Is it strange to be like, oh, fuck, I'm going back again?
Yeah. Well, it's less people to pay, but no, that's not even it, because it works out more, because I had like William emceeing and stuff, and it was brilliant to be able to do that and also have other comedians on as support. Because you can sit backstage and have the crack and chat away, and it's always good fun. But what happened was that whenever I started doing the Nigel stuff, I ended up having to chop a lot of stuff off because, like, well, if I'm going to have a support, then I'm going to have, and then I can be the warm up act in a sense. So I ended up with this one going, because it was doing the Mac, but sorry, with the last show, I was like, they have a projector. So I just put together 5 minutes of the wee sketches that I've done online and put them up. And that was the warm up. And it worked brilliant because people kind of get used to your sense of humour and who they're there to see, as opposed to having a comedian who maybe a slightly different brand of humour than you. So that worked out where that's what I kind of do now, is 5 minute videos. Some have been done specifically for that tour and some are just ones that have been online, and then I come out and do 45 as me, and then, so I think it's good for me to start as me, because again, there's people even come to my shows that don't realise that I'm Nigel. Like, they'll be hanging about after for pictures, and
you walk past them.
They'll be getting pictures of me, and they go, "When's Nigel coming out?" And they're like, "I'm Nigel." And they're, "What? No, you're not." Like, these people actually paid for a ticket to the show, thinking it's two separate people. And I think it's good for people to get a sense of me. I would never start with Nigel because they think it can feel a bit mean spirited if they don't realize that it's a working class person kind of poking fun at the way middle class people see everybody else, as opposed to a middle class comedian looking down on working class people. I think that's why people, even from the West and stuff, love Nigel and what I do, because they see the way that working middle class people look at them in Nigel.
Can I then point out that one of the maddest things I saw that you've done was when you were doing that show and the BT Niners are coming to see you.
Yeah.
I think you put up a clip and it was like the limelight, and there was these women in the front drinking a bottle of Prosecco.
Oh yeah.
I was like, is that real?
You hear their jewellery when they clap. But yeah, that's what I found was that certainly with the shows from last year, once Nigel became more of a like more of the draw, people like kind of do go for Nigel, and then they're there. I was like, well, how do you play this? And I think it was William pointed out, William Thompson, it was the Christmas show in 2018 in the Empire that really kind of, you saw the change, and he'd been with me from the start doing MC, and he was like, Paddy, he's like, they're a really reserved crowd. Like, they're loving it and they're laughing. But when you ask for, when you say, anybody, blah, 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 you know, you're asking for a bit of a contribution, people are putting their hands up to speak to you. They're really polite, a written request. You know,
yeah,
like,
yeah.
May I please speak? So it's a bit different, but it's a mix. It's a mix of working class people and the people from BT9 who want to go and see Nigel. But I think the best bit of feedback I get, and I get it constantly, is that people come up to me after and they're like, look, I hope you don't mind us saying this, but we kind of came for Nigel, but we love you more. And I like that. I'd be worried if people were coming and going, I didn't really like your stuff, but Nigel was great.
They probably have a real guilty pleasure of hearing somebody say fuck, because they're all so well to do.
Yeah, and that changes the Fultons or whatever.
Yeah, exactly. But, you wouldn't catch them saying that during the Methodist Church.
But that's what you say that about seeing the audience, is that to me, like, walking out and like or peering out from behind the curtain before I go on, and you realise what your demographic is, and then that's when I started realising, like, Jesus, there's a lot of BT, and they'll tell you themselves, like, oh, we think you're basing Nigel on, this is my husband, and we all slake him, and they come to it loving it, but I love it at the same time, then they get a flavour of what it was like to grow up in West Belfast as well. And, you know, even though I said Belfast there, I'm doing it as Nigel, I never said Belfast.
I was going to ask you, that is the difference of Belfast, mate.
Belfast.
And Belfast.
Belfast. You almost take, it's like B apostrophe, Belfast, Belfast. But
weird enough, my dad calls it Belfast, but he's a big culture, and he doesn't like that big of a town.
But you know, it's actually something to do with, I think, like, in terms of the name, the emphasis being put on the fast is right. I think, you know, the way, like,
well, I mean, Belfast comes, it comes from Belfast, so it is two words shoved together Belfast, so it's so Belfast.
You wouldn't say mouth of the Farset. No, you mouth of the Farset. I don't know what way you say it, but yeah, it's. I think it is actually right to emphasise the fast as opposed to.
Yeah. Also, don't be pointing out to some of the BT9ers that there are definitely. You're just like, that's an Irish word there. But like,
so much. Is that going to even Shankill being, what is that?
That's right.
Church in the Hill or something like that.
Yeah,
If even.
But you have as I say, with such a mix of a demographic, and then so it was so weird because whenever you started doing that, I was just like, oh, he's doing a Belfast character, and it's going to the UK. You're over doing England.
Yeah, London.
I mean, when you started this, did you go right? I can't do this outside Belfast, and then they're like, can you do a gig in London? You're like, what?
Well, that's I think that again, it's that thing of being blindsided, of not having a plan. is that I think you do start off, and when you know you're doing a spot in an open mic, you kind of set your sights on local material almost, because like, right, I know they'll connect to this, something that happened in the news this week, or local tropes that you aim for, because it's the comfort blanket. And then as time has moved on, and things kind of snowball, people going, aye, but what if you want to take it bigger? It's like, give us a fucking chance. I've only been doing it like 6 months.
Yeah.
And let me, so that's why like the shows are changing. And last year's show, the Postcodes one, was the first time I went, right, I've got sections of material here that are not based on the guitar, or they're not Nigel stuff, it's me. And it was the scurry thing that you used to do all the time with the ones in the scene, which is genuine stand-up, where I put the guitar down, you grab a microphone and you walk about and you fucking act it out and you go off on tangents and shit. And I really wanted to do that, but I always felt like standing behind the guitar, I couldn't, and I didn't have the experience. And it was at that show that I did start doing it, where I was doing stuff about, you know, going in and ordering a Subway, and it was a big 7 minute long thing. And I'm so glad that after it, that was the bit that people came back and they were going, oh, love that song. They were going, that thing about the Subway is fucking brilliant, that's so true, that happened to me. And also that's why the new show and the last, that Christmas one I did there, and just a Christmas pass there, was mostly now I'm actually putting the guitar down a lot more and just doing what I would consider, you know, the more true stand-up that I love watching.
One of my things whenever I started was I missed my drum kit, because I had a microphone behind the kit when I was playing, so you could just say what it meant between songs while people were tuning up or fucking about. Yeah. I would talk.
You could do your own drum roll after you've done a joke.
Exactly. Yeah. But I would have the mic there so I could talk while people were tuning up, because obviously you're playing a band, you're 16, uh-huh. Nobody would buy a fucking tuner. And so you're just talking and telling jokes over. But so whenever I started doing stand up, that was the weird thing, where my first thing was, I'm comfortable on stage, but I'm uncomfortable without my instrument.
Mm.
So well, that must have been a big step for you to go, I'm going to take this. Oh fuck, this is full exposure.
Yeah.
The guitar is that nice wee shield though.
Yeah, totally.
But I mean, if this doesn't work, I'll do it too.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I think that when I look back at the footage it from the Ulster Hall, even though it did the Subway stand up bit, and there was other bits as well that were just, that I'm glad I have, because when I go to England and stuff, I'm like, well, I'm going to go back to that now, and because I could nearly do it without taking the guitar, but I think people feel a bit shortchanged, because in the poster I'm holding the guitar. So like, if I go, I thought we were hearing some few chords here. So but yeah, I was like standing, like leaning on the guitar, almost like it was like leaning at a bar. And it's just restricting, because you've got the mic on the mic stand and you can't go anywhere. And that was something I wanted to kind of ditch, and be able to put the guitar down and go off on one, lift the mic and move the mic stand out of the way. And that's what I did at the Christmas show just gone. There was a lot of material. It was just me. Start with the guitar, put it down, and then go off. And again, it's the best material I find, is that it's where I'm most comfortable. I'm almost like going, can't wait to get rid of the guitar and get stuck into this stuff. So again, it's happened with this one, it's making me realise is that unless it's absolutely necessary, I won't lift the guitar now, you know. But there are some parts that it will be used for. But yeah, so that's the goal, is when I get the England shows, because the London ones flew out. The first one was sold out in a few days, and then the second one has just sold out there at the start of the week, or last week.
Nice work.
So that's two gigs, like there's like an hour, half hour turnaround in between them, in London. And then the other day, I'm putting it down to the fact it's like midweek, but like Liverpool and Manchester are selling a wee bit slower, but there's still over a month to go to those. So
yeah, the other thing is, I know it's from that basis, obviously, because now you're doing an SSE, you've sold out all these bits and bobs, when you're like, oh, that gig's selling a bit slow, but then you're like, I'm doing a gig in Liverpool.
Uh-huh.
That's mental in itself.
Yeah.
You're like, I'm taking Paddy and Nigel over to Liverpool.
Yeah, because I mean, I follow Man United, and I've been to, you know, well, you're a United fan as well.
I am indeed. For my...
I feel, I could sense the aura as I walked in.
I was going to actually put my United top on my day. Did you not see my that was my Instagram on Valentine's Day? Oh, it was me and my United top, just thinking about an abusive relationship.
Yeah, oh God, it's terrible. But I've loved going over and watching United through the years. Only ever get over like maybe once or twice a year, because I'm not fucking made of money, like the price of it. But going to those cities and like flying into Liverpool, maybe even staying there, and then going to Manchester, I'm feeling almost like an alien. Like, I'm only here to observe something. It feels different. It's the first time I'll ever be going to go, I'm going to fucking do something here tonight.
Yeah.
I'm actually contributing to the whatever's going on here. So it'll be class. I'll be looking forward to that.
But that'll be the same thing. Do you think you'll do what Mickey said, was just get one joke to get them connected and then get stuck in?
I already kind of put in the wee tour show stuff about those places already, interwoven without being too much of a you know, a handbrake turn. Oh, I'm going to talk about Manchester for a minute, but there's wee bits put in, like about the Liverpool accent and stuff, that I know will go down well there. But see, to be honest, I know it's going to be 99% people who are like from the road living over there. I'm not going to get necessarily too many walk-ins, but they're going to be bringing people as well, and that's, I suppose, how you maybe set down roots in these places. And so it's not going to be all talking about the Lisburn Road and all that. I'm not even doing the Nigel stuff over there, which I'm really happy about. I don't want to have to rethink that whole thing. I just want to go over and do it as myself.
No, but the other thing is as well, like with the Farmer Michael stuff, because I was over in England with them for 2 weeks in October, November. Mm-hmm. I just sort of, same again, I found a wee bit of local stuff. Like when I was, weirdly enough, when I was in Manchester, I was doing jokes about like the Manchester bomb.
Oh wait, now which one? Are you talking the classic one, 94, was it?
96?
90 something? Yeah, okay.
I was talking about it and they were well into it. Yeah. I have a bit of material where
that sounded awful that I referred to that IRA bomb as the classic bomb, not the more contemporary one.
Yeah, I know. Bomb. Here, like, guys, this is just a podcast. I'm not trying to sink Paddy's career right now. Will you be in the newsletter tomorrow?
We're going to edit that out. Oh, so what was it you said that you were doing a bit about?
I was doing the bit of material I did was because we were doing London and Manchester on the same tour, and I was saying, you know, the great debate of where's friendlier, the north of England or the south of England. Mm. I found out that in my experiences to the north of England, I said, because when I was in London, people asked me, did I know who did Canary Wharf? Because I do a lot of my stuff about being where I'm from.
Yeah.
And I says, but then when I went to Manchester, people thanked me for the new city centre.
It needed cleared out.
Yeah.
Oh, Jesus.
But that's it, because I did a walking tour of Manchester, and the guy talks about like the five phases of Manchester. Mm-hmm. So like one's like a Roman settlement.
Yeah.
And they go through to pre-industrial Manchester and then like music Manchester.
Yeah.
And he says, and this is the new Manchester with the complete regeneration of the city centre.
Yeah.
And then the dude looked at me and I was like, I was too young, one maybe.
What was the podcast he said? There was a load of conspiracies. That could have been, it was all done by like the local
construction firms.
Yeah. Like, let's get this rejuvenated.
Yeah, like, works a bit slow, lads. Any ideas? Pottering?
That's classic. But yeah, that is the stuff, like you said, about doing a walking tour. Whenever I was gigging up in Derry, I mean, I have family from there and also know weird about it, but I wanted to do a walking tour before it, just to get, to get one of those, you know, to get a real feel for the place.
Yeah.
You know, build up as much material. But no, I like the challenge of having to sit down and properly write a wee bit. And there probably are jokes and stuff there that we'd be, without even realising it, I could bring to it. But musically, there's been a wee bit that I've built into the set already that talks about Liverpool and Manchester and stuff, so at least I'll have that anyway.
No, fair play. I think it's clashing all over, man. But yeah, that wee thing, even just give yourself half an hour and take a walk around. This is going to sound really arty. You get a nice vibe of the place.
Oh, no, totally.
And go, yeah, or if you know somebody from there, have a chat with them. Yeah, and be like, yeah. Give me a bit of info.
Yeah.
I was in Derry for half an hour. I checked in the Airbnb and I walked from the Craigan Estate where I was staying across to the Millennium Forum.
Aye.
And within that 20 minutes, I'd scribbled some stuff in my notebook. I was walking, writing stuff down, going this and getting, you know, looking at murals and just that. And I went out and I maybe had five or six new jokes. I did all six of them, but because I opened with them in Derry, they were into it because,
yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. No, it's definitely the way that, and the way these shows have been booked, I do have like a day before when I arrive, I'll be there all day to fuck all, and then even, you know, I'm getting to one of the gigs a full day before, you know, so I'll have that whole day. So yeah, definitely get out there.
How did you find the, one of the things I want to say was, how did you find the balance of not, I mean, you were like, some people want to see Nigel and then like, people appreciate what Paddy's doing. How did you manage to keep, well, I mean, you're opening for yourself. Was it weird to try and keep the balance where you're like, I don't want to be stuck doing, if I have something to say, I don't want to be stuck doing it as another person?
Yeah.
Is this just another thing that you've sort of fluked and, you know, it's like, I wasn't really paying attention.
Exactly. I think that for me, my set always ends up longer than the Nigel set. And because you don't want people, it's like 2 hours start to finish from the show starts until the interval, and then the Nigel set, and then I come back out. It'll be 2 hours from start to finish. And you risk a bit of fatigue there, you know, people being checking their watches, what fucking time is finishing at. So you have to be selective, obviously. And I always find that I put more into my set than I do into the Nigel, because it feels like a bit to me, like a sketch almost. And you don't get, there's no sense of realness, you know, real gravity to it. And I think that that's what comes from the better, the bigger laughs and the more prolonged laughs are whenever I'm doing stuff, and I have more to say and more to talk about than I do for you know, when I'm out there as, pretending to be somebody that I'm not.
Yeah, one of the funny things was, because you do the wee video sometimes where Paddy talks to Nigel.
Aye.
Is that weird?
Yeah, that,
your promo stuff for the SSE was class. I thought that was really good.
Well,
you're shouting at yourself.
Yeah, that was that was like sort of. I just thought if we're going to announce it, it's best to do it that way rather than, you know,
Facebook
like
post.
Like a 400 or something.
West Belfast.
I know. So I wanted to do, and that was the first time putting us both on camera at the same time. But I can't act as me, and I've never acted before, partly in my life. I've never done any kind of acting. I did drama at school. That was just a doss about because it was thick. Couldn't do any other subjects.
I don't want to do technology. I'll take a finger off myself.
I would have, but I couldn't do any of the academic ones. I was like, nah, I can't do that. So I was like, Jesus, what did I do? Like drama, art and sociology. I didn't end up some kind of hipster. I don't know. But like acting as me is just doesn't come naturally, but acting as Nigel could do that all day, which is why the most likely TV show kind of thing I'll be doing will be as Nigel. You know, that character can travel a bit more. Where you put me on TV acting as myself, people are just going to go, that guy's never been in front of a camera before. So even those wee snippets that I did as myself for those promos, it's like, how do you do this? How do you pretend to be normal? It's like strange. It's easier to be a caricature. For me anyway. So
you think Paddy from West Belfast would be best seen by a live studio audience on like the Nolan show giving off?
I think in the audience like the West Belfast Jimmy Bryson. I definitely, like, even with that Nolan show stuff, they wanted me in as Nigel in the studio, and again, like, yeah,
it's like that's a change of tone.
Yeah, and that was the thing with doing that, was like, the whole idea was like to have it at the end of the show in a way it kind of gets gradually less depressing, and then it ended up being plopped in the middle of like talking about the fucking someone that disappeared, and then it's something from Nigel, and then back to health cuts and suicide. You're like, oh my god, that is the worst place to put, you know.
Yeah, I know, and that's what I've got. It's the tone of where the put you.
Yeah, yeah.
You're like, can I open?
Yeah.
And then we'll go on to talk about clerical abuse.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Certainly, that it's that brilliant one in The Simpsons where they announced that a puppy's been run over in the parking lot.
Yeah.
And now please welcome the comedy stallions of Homer Simpson. Yeah. He just walks out to silence.
Yeah. But yeah, so like definitely being myself, it works better on stage. And a lot of the people when they come up, they're like, it's like I can be a bit more like say Kevin Bridges or Billy Connolly. I get compared to a lot because of the guitar and all that as well. And then just telling stories about things that have happened to me growing up. But I can't act that, if you know what I mean. I can just do it, but I can't script that down for myself and then act it out. You just got to get up and do it.
Well, one of my favorite bits is because what is your Snapchats and your Instagrams? So we'll do it again at the end, but because I love watching your wee bits and bobs. I don't know if it's you're bored or you're just keeping your brain ticking.
Probably just bored.
Yeah, the children are asleep. I'm aware.
That's when it all happens.
But one of my favorite jokes you ever did, and I think it was just a little tiny Snapchat, but I was, you know, when something gets you and you're fucking roaring laughing, you don't know why. Mm-hmm. I was roaring laughing at the I think it's you in an airport, the Robert Miles children joke.
Anybody bored, priority boarding.
For anyone with children.
By Robert Miles. Yeah.
I don't know why that just, I was like, there's no fartner joke. And it was so lovely time where you pop the headphones out and go, oh.
That was literally being stuck in the airport and the kids were on the bike going mad and you can actually hear them in the background. But yeah, that's funny because that's one of the things that didn't really go, I can remember the ones that go viral, but yeah, the jokes that I still want to do. And that's kind of a wee bit like, there's a bit in my set that I do and it's the biggest laugh. But it's a weird laugh. It like starts, and it was one of the jokes I nearly dropped because like, this is too ridiculous. People won't get it. But I say about, because I have the guitar and it did a bit of an Ed Sheeran cover, and I talk about Ed Sheeran finding that wee fella. Remember that I say to the audience, he found that wee fella that went missing, Ken Jobs in England. And you see people kind of going, right, don't remember this. And I tell them about this kid went missing and Ed Sheeran and his mates said about looking for him. They found him and there was a reward and they got the reward. And it's pretty heroic. He doesn't talk about it, but there's a line in the song Castle on the Hill where he just throws it in and that's what it refers to. You listen out for this line. And I say, take me back to when we found weekend jobs and we got paid. And like, I nearly dropped that joke. It's like, that's just too fucking ridiculous. And now it's like one of the first ones I'll do if I'm like doing a set somewhere. And you just see people, and like still there might be people going, that's shit. But I that was one of the biggest early laughs.
I'm a sucker for wordplay, man. A good see a good or a well written shit joke.
Yeah, I love that's why I love Sean Hegarty. Yeah, like his it's like I love Tim Vine and Stuart Francis, and then watching Sean do it with a wee sort of a local twist as well. I love all that wordplay shit, and I try not to do too much because I could just be. I do have one liners like that. But I don't want to kind of. I think what's brilliant about Sean is he just bombards you with them, and the best thing is that he just keeps going and going and going. So just maybe one or two every now and again.
I'm the same. I'll be telling a story, but I have the throwaway lines, which is to keep people interested.
Yeah, yeah.
So I say stuff like, you know, oh, my dad's a very traditional Irishman. He's a racist alcoholic, and you just run past it. You're doing it, but it's leading somewhere else.
That's one of the things. Like I listen to. Because even like doing like some podcasts, I just don't have time and I would love to do it. And then whenever I like drop in and listen to everybody else's podcast and listen to how much you all know the craft, like you just know different styles. And, you know, I'm just kind of fucking running with it and going and just trying to pick that stuff up and not necessarily having the theory. It was like me on the guitar. I never took a lesson on the guitar in my life. I'm not a brilliant guitarist, but I made a living out of it in the end.
Yeah.
And it's kind of happened that way with comedy and that I didn't even go to like the local comedy scene gigs until I thought at the start of 2018 I might have a crack at it, and then I went, fuck me, there's actually amazing comedians out there, amazing comedy clubs, Pavilion, Lavery's, and then Cormac was starting his up and there was just so much going on. And I was like, there's an actual proper scene. And that's why I kind of feel like a bit of a fraud in a way. It's like, because I didn't study all this and I don't have a really great depth of knowledge of the types of comedians out there and whatever else. But you know, I'm just doing what I find funny and I'm glad other people do. But like you saying about that, having the wee throwaway lines, it's like I have funny stories that I tell. And then at the start, I was like, right, I got through that because those people are here to see me. But I need to start putting peppering in wee jokes, wee throwaway lines. There are wee tangents to keep people interested because I'm not always going to be in front of my audience.
Yeah.
You know, and I know the punchline's great, but I need to pepper this with a bit more. So, like I said, wee throwaway lines like that, you got to... I can feel it whenever I'm rehearsing at home. I'm going, Jesus, I've been speaking. That was four sentences without a fucking joke there. Come on, paddy up your keys. So, people are paying to see you. But it worked. And that's with the postcode show. I maybe started where I did have a few wee sections where I got off stage and went, fuck, what was that section again? It felt a wee bit like I was just racing towards the next. It's like, try and get something in there. And then you go, actually, yeah, fucking now I have it. And you enjoy. So the actual journey is enjoyable, and then they get the punchline as well.
Yeah.
But like I say, I'm just kind of feeling my way at that still. But I know now to make sure I have it.
Well, so I mean, the main thing is, you've already worked out the craft where any story ends on the payoff or the big punchline, and then in between that, you're doing your wee bits to. It's just keeping people interested and going, this is going somewhere, and then there's the anticipation of where's it going.
Yeah.
Which is really nice to have, where you're just like keep going, but. Good news for you, if you ever do want to actually just drop in and do stuff, I'm now running the Sunflower Comedy Club.
Oh, class, yeah.
This is my shameless plug. So here's what you do, folks. If you want to be good at advertising, right, go and get a mate who's way better at social media than you. Ask him to come on your podcast. And then go, will you retweet this later? And then people will listen to it and go, who's that Darren Matthews fella? I should check him out.
There we go.
Crafty bastard. And he's doing it for the price of a coffee and maybe a handjob. But yeah, so I'm doing the Sunflower Comedy Club once a month and things. So if you're ever bored and you want to try 10 minutes of material,
will do.
Just show up, Paddock.
Is it upstairs?
Upstairs, aye.
What night?
Sunday night.
Every Sunday now?
No, once a month. So the next one is this Sunday, and the tickets are on Eventbrite, and Sunflower Comedy Club is on Facebook and all that crack, and I'll send you all the stuff.
No, I definitely will. After I get this first SSC out of there, there's like a gap between the first and the second. Like the next one isn't until the end of April, so a lot of downtime, and I want to just get out and just keep trying the material, just try new material because I
keep taking over.
Yeah, definitely.
So SSE, I can wrap you up on this. That was so nicely tidied up there. That was lovely. First SSE is the 7th.
Yep.
Of
March,
and it's sold out.
Sold out.
So you can't go to that one. I'm only telling you that one just to rub it in because he sold it out. Second one is when
25th of April.
25th of April. Jeez, that is the gap, isn't it?
Yeah, that was the next one they had after the one that they gave us. So yeah.
That's class, though. So if you don't have, are there any tickets left? Is that sold?
No, that's nearly sold out. So yeah, there's some, but they're kind of not in the best position.
Shh, you don't say that. You just said, sorry, there's still tickets on sale.
They've got a better vantage point, these ones.
Yeah, if you're a sniper. But yeah, bring your binoculars.
I'll have to get a few of them signs from South Armagh sniper at work.
Oh my god, West Belfast man working.
I always wondered looking at them signs because I was into like art and stuff whenever I was doing in school, and like I love murals and all. I was like, I wanted to be a mural painter. I was like, what a job. And then I realised they did it with fucking acetates. Remember the acetates you would have had in school?
Yeah.
I saw one of them it being done one night. I was like, you know, like behind the scenes, the magic was gone. He was there with a fucking looking like a geography teacher painting. And actually, there was a story about a guy who was painting one, then he realized he'd acetate on the round the wrong way to start again.
Did it?
So the slogan was like, you know, Brits out backwards. you can only read it if you're driving away from it and looked at it in your
because
mirror.
You need a mirror. No.
But I was wondering, like, who did that? Like, you seen like the sniper at work in South Armagh, and that sounds like they weren't the best at art. Like is that a sniper, or is that a Labrador licking its own balls or something, you know?
And yeah, I definitely think that somebody got a B in their GCSE art in Cross McGlen High School for that. my favorite one when I was growing up, and something I talk about because obviously it was just the worst thing that ever happened in the fucking country, but the humor that comes out of it now, that nostalgia's all in, man.
Oh yeah.
But my favourite one, and just the wit involved, wasn't the sniper at work. It wasn't like the big green, white and orange armor, you know, IRA that used to sit up on the lamppost.
Yeah.
My favourite one was, there used to be a sign near Bessbrook that used to say, "Beware low-flying helicopters."
Class. Love that bit of humour.
Because they were over in Libya trying to buy like anti-aircraft missiles.
Oh, so was it aimed at like the people beware, or was it saying like beware to the people flying?
Yeah, I think it was just like you just be careful. Like, yeah,
there was a cracker in Lenadoon up behind McGranny's where this guy painted a mural, and it was one of the first ones that wasn't like directly linked to the Troubles, but it was one about the famine, and it like had this like image of a girl taking up, you know, dud spuds out of the ground, and it said on like two gravestones, nature sent the potato blight, England sent the famine, you know, that was the kind of thing. And it was like a gable wall, and I remember like going past it, and there was like a barbecue sitting, like big massive barbecue set sitting like beside the guy's house under, like kind of takes the edge off it a wee bit. It looks like the girl was like disappointed at what she just left out of the barbecue. It was really, really bad taste.
It was actually just sitting there in the mural. My one of my favourite ones was, and something I'd admit to you now because it was about 10 years ago, I used to live in the village. I rented a room, and when I think the first year I moved home from Australia, I was home for a few months before I went away again. I rented a room in the village, and one of the brilliant things was, I don't want to sound sectarian, but loyalists aren't as good at murals. And down in the village, obviously the local paramilitaries had spray painted on the side of, you know, just like a warning to the community. They spray painted "antisocial behaviour will not be tolerated," but they spelled "tolerated" wrong, and then they corrected it.
Right.
So there was a line through the wrong letter, and then they fixed it.
It's been corrected by their teacher.
So me and another friend of mine who lived around there, they had sprayed this inside of somebody's house, and we got a spray can and sprayed underneath it. What? ? Like spray paint in the side of some poor lad's house.
The irony is totally lost there, yeah.
But I just thought that was always fun. But that's not, well, you know what, if you can go from spray painting houses to doing the Odyssey Arena,
if it all goes tits up, I'll be doing murals then.
You'll be doing murals up on thing, yeah.
Get on the eBay looking for an overhead projector.
That is how they do, isn't it? Because they do the small scale, and then they're just like, why is that lad across the road with a generator?
Yeah, turn up at your house. I always loved that, that people had no choice in the matter. If you had a gable wall, it was only a matter of time before there was a rap at the door and there was two fellas there going, you know, with an extension lead, plug out in, we're going to do a mural on the side of your house.
Yeah, one of the good ones. I mean, the other thing as well is growing up in West Belfast, there must have just been so much accidental humour.
Yeah, well, that's what
I play football up in the West, and they're
Blacks Road,
Shaw's Road,
St Paul's. Yeah. Oh, okay.
So I'm playing up there, and the lads on my team, I think I went to two training sessions and got a 3-minute bit out of the lads.
Ah, Do you know what I mean? Easy. And St. Paul's is up, that's where my granny was up, sort of.
Say Leonardine.
Yeah,
so St. Paul's, O'Donovan Ross's, and Sarsfield's are all in one place. It's so weird, three football clubs in one area.
Mad rivalries going on.
Yeah.
But there's loads of that. But what I love doing, the sort of taking, is taking the West Belfast humour and things that I grew up with, and saying, right, just completely awkwardly flip it, what would the BT9 version be of that? And that's how some of that Nigel stuff comes about in the live set, where I would talk about, like Nigel said, we really did, we got it rough during the Troubles, and like just saying that, people start laughing because they know they didn't, and
it's
like
stupidity,
and even the people in BT9 are laughing, kind of going, "Hey, it's like, no, seriously, like you couldn't have got foie gras for loving her money during the Troubles," and that's why we all chanted "Ooh, up foie gras." We started that, so it's like taking the beat and like what would BT9 murals be? So I say, like, Nigel's like, he talks about, I want to bring rejuvenate murals like in the side of houses, and like, you know, like a loyalist one for Gordon Ulster Tatler, and like, you know, maybe just a really nice simple one that's like a recipe for, you know, lobster bisque or something like that, you know. It's like, what would they do with taking, you know, the working class culture and trying to reappropriate it, which always happens. So there's lots of fun to be had with that.
The weirdest thing I find there is you can now switch that. Yeah, it's like a ventriloquism thing, but it's still you.
Yeah. It is. I don't find it. I think whenever I see it then on camera, I go, "Fuck yeah, I sound completely different."
Has your wife ever thought, like, you've been sitting in the kitchen writing jokes, has she ever thought they were getting robbed? Like somebody's in the
fire? Yeah. I thought you were going to say something else, which happened.
Patty, there's somebody in the kitchen!
Which is somebody actually said, like, one of her cousins messaged going, you know, like, whenever I'm wearing the Nigel gear, it's like, do you ever ask Patty to keep the Nigel gear on? I was like, oh my fucking god, no way. She's actually turned by Nigel.
Yeah.
Not turned on, like, as in physically turned on.
Do you know why? It's because he looks like an RUC man.
Yeah. whenever I take the wig off, like after I film the video, I film a lot of them in the shed, and whenever I've finished, I'm like just so keen to get it edited and put it up, and I just take the wig off and the glasses, and I'd be sitting, I forget that I have a moustache on, and I answered the door for, I'd ordered a pizza and forgot I had to take the moustache off, so I answered the fucking door with a cravat and a shirt on, but it was only filming from like the waist up, so a pair of tracksuit bottoms, Adidas tracksuit bottoms, a shirt, a cravat, bald head and a fucking handlebar moustache, and answered the door to a pizza delivery fella, and I couldn't work out why he was looking at me all weird, and I was saying, oh shit, I don't even think he knew anything, he just thought I've answered the door to, I've delivered a pizza to a serial killer, it just looked like,
or this is definitely how the plot of a gay porn starts. Mom with a big handlebar attached,
it's a hungry,
oh, the pizza's,
it's
here,
a hungry Jobs and a 12 inch shirt. Oh.
Oh man, made face for an age, isn't it?
all the meats.
Oh god.
Oh Jesus.
No, I'm gonna let you set you free to let you go back home to your loving wife. Well, actually, I might go get a coffee first. I'm gonna get coffee. You're drinking water.
Sweet.
So Paddy, thanks for coming on.
No problem. Thanks for having me. First podcast.
Really?
Yeah.
You need to do more of this stuff.
And
not like you need the press, but I think it's, I think it's good for comedians as well, because people sort of maybe helps you get where you're coming from as well.
Yeah.
Because you're saying it's such a shock value for people to see Nigel and then be like, by the way, I'm Paddy, and people are like, what the fuck?
No, you're right. And I enjoy listening to everybody's podcast, because like you do get an idea, because even whenever I've gone to doing gigs in the scene, you see them do their set, you don't really get a good flavour of who the actual person is. Some are quite themselves, but some are like a character of themselves on stage, and then when you hear the podcast you realise that this is the person behind it, even if it's not a character that they're playing. So yeah, definitely want to start doing more of that, and I think that after the sort of SSE gigs are over and whatnot, that I'll be able to maybe have a bit more
so time. Obviously that's the goal at the minute, so get them out of the road and then take a bit of time.
There's TV, I'm doing a bit of writing, pitching stuff to BBC Comedy in London, so that's why I've left nothing booked in after the SSE, because I want to leave a bit of space to be able to write that. So that'll be doing writing that, and then touring some of the older material, because I don't want to have to just keep fucking writing new shows. I think I'm on to like the fourth now in 2 years, and it's not enjoyable having to sit and, you know, rack your brain worrying, is this funny, and how, you know, then I'm gonna have to tour it, and if so I just want to be able to not do something live for a while,
because you are so busy as well. Writing for that must be way worse, because like I sort of write when the notion takes me, but you're like, that's the date, that's booked,
gotta get it done. I work better like that though. When I've got like a deadline, as opposed to just sort of having carte blanche, just I like having a deadline to work towards, and I sometimes even just laze about until like close to the deadline, and then I do it better then, but it's not the best way to work. But yeah, just I've not much. Everything that I've got booked in for the rest of the year or on the cards isn't going to be writing new material, except for the TV stuff, which will be a bit more sedate. Won't be as nerve-wracking.
See, when you were growing up the West with your four siblings, did you ever think you would be going to your ma and dad going, I'm a writer now? They're like, you're fucking lazy, yeah, but you are.
Yeah, that wouldn't have sat well in with the likes of my dad. Very sort of straight-laced kind of guy. So none of this fucking about on stage, which is why I never tried doing comedy. It was because I loved watching Billy Connolly growing up and loved watching comedy, but never thought, I'm going to try that. You never thought, because if you dicked about at a party, like your parents had a few people around and you came in and you said something, you got a big laugh, you just knew you'd look and my dad just be top and going, like, you're fucking, you're getting like that, you freak. Get out, get you up to bed. You're 25, you know.
And you're like 16, but you
yeah,
heard me.
I know, so yeah, that was never really thought, but nah, it's great crack, enjoying it.
You ain't got nerve wracking. I had to be in the house with my hair dyed bright red the time that my ma told my granny I was playing in a punk band called Too Fat for Porn. You think you've got problems?
pouring what? Pouring my little porn. Too
Fat. What's that?
So did you just record anything, or is it just like?
Yeah, we recorded two EPs. One was actually called Crap, but spelled with a K. And then the second EP was called And the Wiener Is. Okay. So very highbrow stuff.
Was the crap backwards, like corn's K, like the K, like corn? Crap?
No, I never thought to do that. Damn it! No, we did it like the cover art was done like, remember in the old Batman series whenever somebody got punched?
It was
like that splat. It was crap. So
pop art kind of thing.
Yeah, no.
I'm going to Google that later, just so I've got an excuse for my search history saying too fat for porn, and then whatever rabbit hole that takes me down. Then I will.
Yeah, exactly. It's like BBW. I was actually googling B&M bargains, but I'm dyslexic.
I was looking for BMW, and it auto corrected it. You know,
going to buy a new car when the auto stalls. I swear to God. Jesus, right, Paddy, where do people find you on the socials? Because people will now be googling Paddy, Nigel. That probably works.
I might do. It's all sort of at Paddy Raff Comedy. So Facebook, Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Yeah.
Instagram.
At Paddy Raff Comedy.
So at Paddy Raff Comedy. There you go. Consistent across the board. When you find them on one, there'll be links to the others. If you haven't seen Paddy, where else? So the Odyssey, you've done all the other dates and the thing, yes?
Yeah, the tour's kind of done, but then there's going to be a few more dates announced in between the two Odyssey shows to kind of keep things going. So I think doing Bangor, Newry, because I worked in Newry for a few years and loved it down there, so I want to get back down. And Bangor, Newry, and then I think Portico and Portaferry as well. So okay. There'll be some more regional shows announced in between the two SSEs that'll be doing.
Better be doing new for me. We're going to talk about this after.
Aye, okay.
Right. No, but, guys, if you've enjoyed the podcast, usual crack, like, share, and subscribe. Darren Matthews and Sometimes Friends. This has been episode 20, which has actually been great crack, so thanks for coming down.
No problem.
It's been helping me do something productive on my day off, because I've been avoiding doing, you know, recycling and washing. So, ladies and gentlemen, Paddy Rafferty. Paddy, say bye.
Cheerio.
Thanks very much, guys. Chat to you soon.